Sinan Antun is an Iraqi-born poet and filmmaker who left his homeland after the Gulf War in 1991. He teaches Arabic literature at New York University, and in July 2003, he returned to Iraq with a group of filmmakers to co-direct a documentary called About Baghdad, a look at life in Iraq in the early days of the U.S. occupation. Add to his accomplishments a novel called Ijam, an Iraqi Rhapsody. It was recently published in an English translation by City Lights, and I'm very pleased to welcome Sinan Antun to my show today. Hello.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What does the book's title, Ijam, mean?
It's one of those words that has two antithetical meanings. One of them is to make, to clarify, and the other is actually to make ambiguous and obfuscate. And while it has...
A word do those two different things? That the word itself is describing itself, I guess.
Well, it has to do with the development of the Arabic script, because initially Arabic script started without dots. I mean, there are 28 letters, half of which have one or two or three dots. But initially, because you can judge from context, the dots were not actually written. And then to avoid ambiguity, the dots were borrowed from Aramaic, which was a foreign language. So dotting...
That's why Hebrew has dots.
Yeah, it's
the vowels, but many people could read Hebrew without the vowels.
It's true, and you can read Arabic without the vowels and the dots, but that leaves a space for ambiguity, and that's what I'm playing on.
And in the basis of this novel as well, because a manuscript is found in a prison that was written by a prisoner, but it's missing the dots.
Yes, and when the dots are missing, you can make out 85% from context and grammar, but then if there are puns or wordplay, you cannot really arrive at the exact meaning 100%. So the whole idea was for the prisoner to start writing in prison and make sure that his jailers would not be able to make out what he's thinking. It was kind of a way to dodge the authorities in a way.
And then someone from the Ministry of the Interior deciphers it.
Yes, tries to decipher it, and he deciphers most of it, but I mean, it also shows kind of the levels of authority, because in being a loyal bureaucrat, he has to, you know, put a footnote about the puns, and the puns sometimes have very obscene meanings that have to do with authority and with the dictator, so... It shows that in the authorities or powers' quest to account for everything, it exposes itself.
Those puns must have made the translation rather difficult.
It did, but actually, I mean, Rebecca Johnson, my friend who is the co-translator, she did a great job. And while sometimes it's not exactly identical, but it does carry the meaning over. So we only left out one of those puns, actually.
You worked with her because you speak English fluently. Mm-hmm. That must have made it easier as well.
Yeah, I mean, she did most of the work, but sometimes she would consult with me, and she usually came up with very creative solutions.
And some of the puns are the writer refers to the Ministry of Rupture and Inflammation instead of the Ministry of Culture and Information. That's something that is obviously obvious, but also because the words are so similar without the dots, he can get away with it?
Yes, and Arabic is very rich because of the root system, like other Semitic languages. So there are, you know, multiple possibilities for wordplay.
Ijam takes place during the Iran-Iraq War, and it tells the story of a college student who's imprisoned. How common was it for students to be persecuted under Saddam's regime?
Well, a lot of people were persecuted. Anyone who was deemed to pose a threat to the regime would be. And, you know, universally, as much as I'm cautious with the word universal, students and workers, I would think, tend to be, because of their environments, and especially students, to be more exposed to other ideas and be young. So, and the College of Arts, which I went to in Iraq, had a history of political involvement going back to the 30s and the 40s.
He's also not just a student, he's a poet, and he quotes Iraqi poetry and remembers watching a television interview with Al-Jarahi, an Iraqi poet who lives in Prague. Now, I want to get into the whole matter of people living in exile, but I was thinking about Prague and its possible significance, because many people have seen parallels with Kafka's The Trial.
Well, there's a historical connection in that, you know, in even before Saddam and even in the early years of the Ba'ath, the Iraqi Communist Party had a very strong constituency before it was decimated by the Ba'ath regime. And there were good relationships with many Eastern European countries, also because they gave generous scholarships. But it just so happened that a lot of the Iraqi communists and pro-communist intellectuals were exiled to Eastern Europe, and Prague became a place where many Iraqi students had gone to study, but many of the intellectuals also. And this Al-Jawahiri, who was one of the greatest poets of the 20th century in the Arab world, was in Prague, and that kind of invited other people to join him as well.
So intellectuals just went into exile?
Well, they were forced to by the regime. And since you already had a community there of people there, it made it easier, I think. But ironically, I mean, before Saddam, the regimes were more benign. I mean, Jawahiri had to leave under Abdel Karim Qasim, who was, you know, a dictator, but things were a little bit more fluid. But he realized that it would be a danger for him to stay on because he was outspoken.
How aware were people back in Iraq of what was being done by these exiles?
Of course, there was no internet and whatnot, but you had radio, and because the Jawahiri had already established himself from the 40s and he was a national figure, so people would seek out news about him, and people listen still in the Arab world to BBC in Arabic and other radio stations. The radio is an amazing thing still, I think.
What about today? Could you have written and published this book in Iraq?
No, not under Saddam, of course, and that's why, although I started writing it there, I published it much later in Beirut. Now you can publish, but it's not because it's better, but because now there is chaos and there is no state. And so,
but there are people who get killed for saying the wrong thing.
Yeah, there are people who get killed just for going and buying groceries. So, and now, you know, intellectuals are being attacked by militias, and it's random. And I hate to make it sound, because the question is always, was it better under Saddam? And I think this question should not be asked. It should be said, is it worse now? And it is. Because under dictatorship, and there are red lines, and so you know what to do in order to survive. Now you don't know what to do in order to stay alive.
My guest is Sinan Antun. His novel, Ijam, an Iraqi Rhapsody, has been translated into English and is being published by City Lights. Well, it's just a difference of what's bad and what's good. People often point out that there was more electricity, that the infrastructure worked better, that the hospitals were in good shape during Saddam, and none of those things are true today. But on the other hand, I'm not sure. What is better right
now? Theory.
Now?
In theory, it's better because, of course, whenever dictators are gone, it's better. But we tend to forget that democracy is not just going to the election and showing your thumb. But if you need to have a sustainable life. And as you said, if you don't have electricity and you and your family cannot go to work or school safely, and there is no clean water, who cares if theoretically you can practice your democracy, but you can't even go across town to go and vote for your party?
What led you to leave Iraq in 1991?
I always wanted to leave because it wasn't fun living under a dictatorship, but I thank you for this question. In 1991, everyone seems to forget, you know, we should always talk about the occupation in 2003, but in 1991, the first Gulf War was to eject Saddam out of Kuwait. And okay, most Iraqis were for ejecting Saddam out of Kuwait, but the bombing really destroyed the infrastructure of Iraq and left indelible marks. And at the time, an American general said, we bombed them back to the pre-industrial age. So it wasn't just me. In the 90s, 3 million Iraqis left. And that was the beginning with the sanctions of the erosion of Iraqi social fabric and the disappearance of the middle class, which created later all this void.
Did you come directly to the United States?
Yeah, because I wanted to go to graduate school as well.
And did you leave family back in Iraq?
I left family, but they left one after the other with me in the 90s. So, and the last person left 2 years ago because of the, you know, the fruits of American democracy were, you know, she was a 70-year-old lady who was my aunt, and she could not live. So she lives in Amman now.
Do you feel any frustration watching what's going on in your homeland through television mostly and newspapers?
Not just frustration, but pain, of course. And I think it's not just because I'm from Iraq. I think any human being with a conscience would be really devastated to see what's happening. But let me also say what saddens me, because in going around and talking about Iraq and the film and the novel, people say, well, what can we do now? What really scares me is that nothing has been learned by the citizenry, by all of this. So now in the discourse about Iran, a lot of people are misled this very same way. And they're concerned about Iran, and they take these phony reports for granted.
We were just talking to filmmakers about what the American view of what went wrong in Iraq was. You returned to Baghdad in July 2003 to make a documentary called About Baghdad. I'm not sure whether it was your first time back, mm-hmm. but it was. You talked to people about how they saw what had happened since the occupation. And it's kind of shocking.
It is.
And do you think that Americans have enough of a sense of how Iraqis feel?
No, and that's why we made the film, actually, because in the, you know, the before the war, you know, like this country was going to commit lives and billions of dollars, but you never really heard from Iraqis. Iraqis were presented as one-dimensional human beings. You had one or two Iraqis who are, this Iraqi friend told me X, Y, and then they all think the same way. So our main objective was to show that Iraqis, like other human beings, happen to be from different classes and different backgrounds and have complex opinions, and hating Saddam does not equal loving America. For a very important reason is that America supported Saddam and maintained the sanctions.
People I've spoken to say that they've been shocked by just how run down Baghdad has become and just the extent of the destruction.
I was shocked too, although I followed the country's news on a daily basis. But it's, you know, now Iraq looks like any other third world country, but frankly, the sanctions are not talked about enough. It's the sanctions that really, really did a number on Iraq and really, you know, destroyed the country for good.
In the film, you went to Al-Jajail and heard stories of torture and execution and imprisonment. What happened in Al-Jajail?
Al-Jajail is the place where a number of Iraqis in the beginning of the 80s, they tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein. And, of course, they failed. And, you know, his vengeance was to uproot the trees and kill and torture a lot of people.
Well, you've written about torture in this novel. I assume that you'd written those scenes before you'd spoken to these people, but I guess everybody knew about the torture.
Yes, we used to hear stories, and I also got into reports of human rights organizations. But the sad thing is that, you know, and this jail was used in Saddam's trial, but you never talk to the people themselves. I mean, they were having the first public commemoration of that, and you know, we were the only crew there. None of the hundreds of journalists were interested in going and speaking to the very victims that they speak about them, but never to them.
Some of the Iraqis mentioned their resentment toward people like Ahmad Chalabi, who'd lived in exile and never experienced life under Saddam Hussein and then returned as conquering heroes after Saddam fell. Do they blame him or do they blame his American sponsors?
They blame Saddam and the American sponsors. But the thing about Chalabi, you know, Chalabi mastered the game in Washington, D.C. in the Beltway, but Chalabi never had a chance in Iraq. Because the Iraqis, as terrible as the situation is, as I said, you know, they listen to radio, they listen to news. He had no chance whatsoever, ever. No one will accept a nobody who has no record and who actually was known to be wanted in Jordan for corruption and for crimes. Iraqis are not going to accept, I mean, no people on earth is going to accept a crook to be their president just because he's in bed with the Americans.
Did anyone feel any resentment toward you because you've been living in exile?
Very few people, in a way. I mean, I could understand, but most people at the time were moved that we were independent and we'd come to make a film about them. There was a couple of people who initially were resentful, and I just told the guy, look, I'm not here to take money from you. I'm not here to steal away your job. I'm here to make a film about you. But 95% of the people were really moved because at the time they wanted to tell their stories because they were never listened to.
Do you think you'll ever move back to Iraq?
You know, I initially had wanted to go back and help out, but frankly, you know, it's impossible to walk down the street without being shot. And if 5 million Iraqis have left in the last 4 years, I don't know. Maybe I'll go in my 60s or 70s, but, you know, it will take two generations to bring the country back to any normalcy.
Well, you wrote a novel, and I assume that all of this is good material for future novels. Are you working on another one?
Yes, I'm working on a novel about collateral damage, actually.
This one is called Ijam, I'JAAM, An Iraqi Rhapsody. It is published now in an English translation by City Lights. And I want to thank its author, Sinan Antun, for being on my show today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.